Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. This is National Suicide Prevention Week, and suicide is the 10th leading cause of all deaths in the United States and the 9th leading cause in South Dakota. Ann Kelly is a professor of psychology at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell, as well as a psychological autopsy investigator. Her research is aimed at improving prevention efforts and taking the stigma out of suicide, depression, and mental illness. She joins us on the line. And Ann, thanks for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, in talking about suicide prevention, I'm wondering if there are certain challenges in preventing suicide.
Well, there are, and those challenges are unique to misconceptions we have about psychiatric illness, about suicide, and also about well-being in general, and some of those can be bound to regions in which we live, including South Dakota. And all of those need to be addressed in order to really develop and implement effective prevention and intervention programs.
In talking about misconceptions, what are some of those?
Well, misconceptions around psychiatric illness tend to cluster around a few ideas we have about psychiatric illness, including major depressive disorder, and those are that they aren't real. We tend to not think of them as medical illnesses. And when we acknowledge that we are, we then feel helpless to do anything about them. So if we're willing to understand that, in fact, these are medical illnesses with which people are struggling and living, we then need to get to the next step of saying, what can we do without throwing up our hands and feeling overwhelmed by it? And we can do things about it. There's certainly treatments that are beneficial to people, including cognitive behavioral therapy and medication. And when people receive these treatments, they often do benefit from them. So they're treatable problems. And we need to address the idea that they aren't treatable. People also tend to think that psychiatric illness cannot go hand in hand with success. So when we see successful people and find out that they've been diagnosed with psychiatric illness, it doesn't really fit our idea of them. So those are a couple of the misconceptions we have.
I'm wondering if you think some of that is changing the more that mental illness is being discussed. It seems like maybe in the past few years that people are more willing to talk about this on, you know, in forums like this, for example.
Sure, and we are seeing more awareness brought to these issues, particularly around celebrities, for example. And there have been several suicides in the news, which we don't need to get into in any great detail, but it is worth mentioning that Robin Williams' suicide brought a tremendous amount of attention to psychiatric illness and to suicide in general and opened up that conversation. And through that tragedy, we can learn more about mental illness and the numbers of people suffering from it. So I do think that it's changing. I hope that it's changing. The stigmas we have around mental illness tend to be pretty ingrained in our culture. We have kind of this rugged individualism in America and in South Dakota, too. It's very common in rural areas, and we believe that we need to solve our problems on our own, and reaching out for help is a sign of weakness, and we need to overcome that. I think having conversations just like this one opened the door for those conversations to take place. Looking at the Robin Williams suicide opens the door for these kinds of conversations, but it's important to remember that they need to continue. I read a statement yesterday, in fact, that said approximately 3,000 more Americans have died by suicide since Robin Williams' death. So there's significant issues that do need to be addressed, and I think we're beginning to overcome, again, I hope, some of those misconceptions around it.
Is suicide always the result of a mental illness of one sort or another?
The majority of people who die by suicide have a psychiatric illness. Perhaps not all, but certainly the majority of them do. And 9 out of 10 people who die by suicide have an untreated or untreated psychiatric illness. So we get into the issue of treatment, too, for illness. And if treating and addressing psychiatric illness doesn't eliminate the problem entirely, it certainly can eliminate it to a great extent. And that's why we think of suicide as one of the most preventable problems, because there is this element of illness very typically involved, and people aren't always receiving the adequate treatment that they need in order to get better. And so we need to be addressing that.
So what is the role of family members when, in helping someone receive the necessary treatment, particularly as you mentioned, a lot of us are, have that rugged individualism that we can take care of this ourselves, and maybe someone who's suffering is maybe a little reluctant to ask for help.
Right, and sometimes people who are suffering are reluctant to ask for help. Interestingly, though, the majority of them do communicate it in some way. And as family members, as friends, as colleagues, it's important that we be attuned to what those warning signs are and how the need for help is communicated, because the need for help won't always be, as you said, in the form of a direct verbal clue. People may be hesitant to come out and say, I wish I were dead, or pretty soon you won't have to worry about me. You won't always hear that. Instead, you need to be paying attention to some behavioral clues. Are you seeing changes in behaviors? And some changes in behaviors will be indicative of psychiatric illness. For example, with depression, some of the changes we will see would be increased hopelessness, a lack of energy, a loss of interest in activities that people have enjoyed. You might also see an increase in irritability or anger. And that's indicative of psychiatric illness, not necessarily just suicide, but you need to be attuned to those clues too. In suicide, it might be somebody stockpiling pills. It might be somebody acquiring a firearm or beginning to put their personal affairs in order. You might have somebody call you and tell you that they're very sorry for anything that has happened that they feel responsible for in your life. So any kind of apologizing or trying to make things good might be indicative that someone's thinking about ending their life. Another sign that family members and friends need to watch out for is somebody giving away prized possessions. If somebody gives away their car or stereo, something they love, that's an indicator that things might not be quite right. And often these are accompanied with direct verbal clues. Someone may say, that's okay, I won't need it anymore after next week. And that's an indication that you should pay attention. In addition to looking at behavioral clues and listening for any verbal clue if it's offered, you need to be attuned to their situation, because situations pose unique risks. If somebody loses a job, they're either laid off, the economy's bad, they're fired, or if someone is expelled from school, or if someone is having a difficult time at school, failing classes, pay attention to that. If somebody moves across the country, or even from one town to another, or a house to another house in the same town, and it's an unwanted move, this could be a real stressor. Any kind of loss, including the loss of a mentor, a counselor, a teacher, a pastor, these are significant losses that are going to disrupt somebody's life. So we really need to pay attention to all kinds of warning signs that, as I said, are verbal, behavioral, or situational, and may be indicative not just of suicide ideation, but also of psychiatric illness. And we need to respond to those.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This is National Suicide Prevention Week, and our guest is Ann Kelly. She's professor of psychology at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell. And Ann, you mentioned earlier that geographic isolation can cause problems that lead to suicide. So that's I'm wondering why that is, particularly since South Dakota is full of these isolated areas.
Right, and that's what makes it a real problem for us living in South Dakota. Rural suicide risk is much higher than the risk for people living in urban areas, and there are a few reasons for that. Largely, we have limited access to mental health professionals. There are barriers to psychological treatment that include traveling long distances, potential transportation problems. That could even be weather and the difficulty of making appointments in snow or ice. We also have the stigma piece here, which we've already mentioned, but really the access to mental health professionals is a hard challenge to overcome when you're looking at geographic isolation. We certainly have many, many excellent counselors throughout South Dakota who do their very best to reach out to people in isolated areas, but it's hard. So that's a real limitation. In addition to access, and transportation and distance issues. We also run into access to firearms. We have a lot of them, and we know how to use them. We see that people are more comfortable using firearms in rural areas than they tend to be in other areas. Poverty often accompanies geographic isolation and puts people at increased risk for suicide, too. So those are some of the factors that are going to increase our risk in rural areas.
Now, and Kelly, I understand you were recently certified as a psychological autopsy investigator, and I'm curious as to what that job entails and how that fits with your research and study into suicide.
Sure, yeah. Well, there are a couple of different things that psychological autopsy investigators do. I am a research psychologist, and my interest in using psychological autopsy investigation tools is to better identify causes of suicide and risk factors. And within that, I'm looking at what we would call proximal risk factors and also distal risk factors. So what puts us at immediate risk for suicide, and what are some long-term risk factors with which people live that make them vulnerable over their lifespan? And I focus on what happens in individual cases that triggers a suicide at a particular time. And then, ideally, I can look at these individual cases across a group and identify groups that are at highest risk. And then we can develop strong intervention programs targeting these particular groups. So that's the research end of the psychological autopsy investigation piece. But that's not all I do. Families often, after suffering the loss or death of someone by suicide, have a lot of questions. They often feel confused. They want more answers. And I am available to help families through that process by looking at what was going on in the individual's life at that time. And I interview family members, I interview friends, I interview people who worked with or went to school with a victim who died by suicide. And we develop a very complete picture of what was going on in this individual's life in the 2 weeks prior to suicide, days prior to suicide, 6 months prior to suicide, and in the years leading up to it. We also look at medical examiner reports. We also look at police reports so that we have a very full picture of the circumstances of death. And in some cases, people really aren't certain that their family member died by suicide, which isn't to say that the police didn't do their job well, and of course, I'm sure they did, but they just want to know more. And in that case, we can look at cause, and we can look at mode and manner. You know, was it natural causes? Was it homicide? Did it seem likely that under the circumstances we've been able to reconstruct that it would be a suicide? So that's something we do. And in some cases, law enforcement come to a crime scene, potentially a crime scene, or what could be a suicide scene, and just aren't sure. And they want a little more information. And spending time meeting with family members and friends and going through the mental health history and behavioral health history of a victim isn't something that they're equipped to do or have the resources to do, in which case I can become that resource for them and help them. So I serve a number of people in this position, research being one of those, families and law enforcement.
The research aspect of it, it would seem from looking at so many of these cases that it helps maybe clarify some of the things that we need to understand about, you know, the cause and the risk factors of suicide, many of the things that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think it does. Rarely do you have someone die by suicide who has a psychiatric illness and nothing else going on in their lives. That's not typically going to lead to a suicide. Usually you're looking at a combination of risk factors in relation to what we call protective factors, or factors that are going to buffer individuals from the likelihood of suicide attempt or thinking about suicide. So what I do is really try to look at how these factors are working together. We might have a psychiatric illness diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Lots of people have bipolar disorder. Having that does not mean that you are going to attempt suicide. It does elevate your risk, but suicide is by no means an inevitable conclusion, not at all. So what are some other factors that are going to increase risk for suicide among those diagnosed with bipolar? And that allows us to become much more specific in targeting a group so that we can develop an intervention program for that group in particular, not to the exclusion of other groups. Those continue to run and be developed, but in addition to.
Well, finally, and Kelly, you were talking about families. I'm wondering for how difficult it is for family members not to blame themselves for a loved one's suicide, especially in those cases when they've done everything they can. They saw the risk factors and they worked to get the treatment, to get the help. You know, how difficult is it for family members not to blame themselves?
I think it is incredibly difficult. I don't want to put myself in the position of someone dealing with those circumstances and guess, but I would say based on the feedback that I've received from family members and from friends, it would be very rare for me to find someone who at some point did not blame themselves for it, who did not take responsibility, who did not look back at one moment where they believed they could have done something differently and changed the entire outcome. And if there's one thing that I could take from those people, it would be to take away the pain they live with around the issue of guilt and responsibility because it does not belong to them, but they do seem to live with it. And that's something I would like us culturally, too, to be able to overcome, you know, that there is no blame here, that is not what suicide and suicide prevention are about.
All right. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you. I appreciate your having me.